In recent years, beloved listeners, a reckoning has been happening with old historical narratives across the world, including, of course, in Australia, but not so in China, where history is seen as legitimising the Chinese Communist Party's hold on power. There, the party goes to great lengths to control the story in textbooks, on TV, even in video games. But that hasn't stopped people from trying to expose the darkness, the dark truths of the past. Ian Johnson is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who has covered China for, well, for decades. And in a new book, he introduces us to the writers, filmmakers and artists that are challenging the CCP's version of history at their own peril. His book is called Sparks, China's Underground Historians and Their Battle for the Future. Welcome to the program, Ian. An old friend of mine, Simon Winchester, wrote a masterpiece called The Man Who Loved China, but that title seems to apply to you. When did the love begin?
It began in 1984 when I went to China for the first time. I had been taking Chinese before that, but it was more of a lark, something that I needed to fulfill a language requirement, to be frank. But when I took my teacher's advice and went to China on an exchange program. This is the period when China was just really opening up. And I fell in love with the place. It also made me realize how lousy my Chinese was and that I would have to go back and study more. But it was a fascinating time. The country was just a few years past the Mao era. And there was a sense of renewal and rebirth in the country that was tangible.
Now, since then, you've studied, lived and worked in China on and off for many years. What is it that kept you going back?
Well, I think it was the sense of change and renewal that was going on. I suppose it's like within many cultures that at first you may think that you have a handle on it, but the more that you learn about it, the more you realize you need to know more, that you haven't really mastered it or understood it. And so I kept wanting to understand more. And I think also it was my engagement throughout most of my time as a journalist with grassroots China that kept me from getting jaded. Because I think if you deal with elite Chinese politics, it's easy to get somewhat tired of the country because the top leadership is somewhat depressing. But when you're dealing with ordinary people and their lives and struggles, it's a constantly interesting topic, for me at least.
Let the record show, beloved listeners, that Ian returned to live in China after his time as a newspaper correspondent to focus on long-form journalism and his books. Now, I think it's fair to say that many leaders try to use history for their political advantage, but can you just explain why history is so absolutely important to the CCP?
Yes, as you mentioned in your introduction, history matters to many countries, and we all tell national myths about our countries. Many of them have been deconstructed in recent years, but for the Chinese Communist Party, it's absolutely essential, because if you begin to think of it, you wonder, well, why does the CCP run China? Of course, the short answer is that it won a civil war in 1949, and that's why it took control of the country and hasn't relinquished control. But that's not a very edifying story to tell the populace. So it has come up with a story, a myth, a national myth, that China was laid low in the 19th century, opium wars, etc., which is all true, but that it was the Communist Party which saved China in 1949 by taking power, making the country whole again, and putting it on the path to wealth and power. And again, with all national myths, there are elements of truth to that. The CCP took power in 49, and since then it has become an economic superpower. But there have been many hiccups and tragedies over those intervening 75 years. So those things the party doesn't want to talk about and tries to whitewash them. And the independent historians, unofficial historians, they see their role as trying to balance the historical record a bit.
I remember on my first trips to China hearing stories of the Long March tunnel with the same religious reverence as Moses leading the Jews out of Egypt. But could you be kind enough to sum up the official CCP narrative for the last 100 years or so?
Yeah, the CCP was founded in 1921, and they would say that in the late 19th century, the first half of the 20th century, there were well-meaning patriots who did try to save China, but they were failures until the party took control. And when the party was then able to push through a modernizing project that essentially bullwhipped China into modernity, created a nuclear power, a modern army. It fought the United States to a standstill in the Korean War, so of course, with Soviet aid. But this was quite sensational when you think that China had suffered a century of one military defeat after the other. But here it was standing up to the United States and holding its own. And then had a space program and did all these things that sort of modern superpowers do, and has now created this economic power. And I guess some young people might say, or some people might say in China, well, that's all well and good. You did that in the middle part of last century. What have you done for us recently? And the party's answer to that question of performance legitimacy is to say, well, we keep running the country because we're doing such a good job. Nobody could do such a good job as we do. And they don't put that to the test at a ballot box, but they simply assert this. And anybody who challenges it doesn't have a voice in China. They may be locked up, or they may simply be canceled and not allowed to have a social media platform or to publish or make films, etc. But essentially, that's how they justify control.
I seem to feel that the collapse of the Soviet Union intensified the desire, the need to control the narrative.
Yeah, that's a really interesting topic, because after the Soviet Union collapsed, the leaders of China at the time in the early 90s, Deng Xiaoping and his handpicked successors, the conclusion they drew was that economics had sunk the Soviet Union. And so they supercharged China's market-oriented reforms and pushed it forward through the 1990s, creating a more and more of a market-based economy to solve things like consumer shortages and so on and so forth, thinking that this would make people happy. And it actually worked quite well. China had a thriving economy in the 90s and 2000s and for part of the 2010s. But the current leadership under Xi Jinping has drawn a different conclusion. And that is that while economics mattered, it was the ideological hollowing out of the Soviet Union under Gorbachev that caused it to collapse. Because there were two parts to him. One was perestroika, which was economic reconstruction. The other was glasnost, which was opening. And they see the glasnost as the problem, allowing the questioning of Soviet history, allowing the crimes of the Stalin era to be aired in public. That was a cardinal mistake, according to Xi. And he's spoken about this quite openly and said that at the end of it, when the Soviet Union was collapsing, there was nobody who was man enough, he even uses that term, there was nobody man enough to just put their foot down and say, enough is enough, we're sending in the tanks, we're not allowing the Soviet Union to collapse. And he said, that's not going to happen with China. We're going to make sure we control the historical narrative. The past will not be questioned. And no one's going to question or wonder why the CCP runs China.
They certainly control the adjectives, because the party is always great, glorious, and correct.
Yes, those are the grand, great party, and it has to run China into the foreseeable future. There's sort of no end in sight.
So the atrocities that occurred during the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution, or Tiananmen, have been downplayed or downright lied about.
Yes, these are the cardinal sins, even something earlier than that, the so-called landlord campaign in the late 40s, early 50s. This is when they killed up to about 2 million so-called landlords. These were often just small landowners. They were the people, the landed gentry that essentially ran rural and local life in China. They were all eliminated early on.
And we're talking huge numbers, aren't we?
Yes. I mean, we just sort of write that off. Oh, only 2 million dead here. And of course, the anti-rightist campaign, 600,000 people sent to camps and so on. And in a country at that time, especially in the 50s, that was quite illiterate, 600,000 people represented the majority of, or a large percentage of, the intelligentsia in the country. It was similar to Pol Pot in Cambodia, without killing them all, but essentially sidelining them. So that allowed him to push through these maniacal economic plans like the Great Leap Forward, which killed up to 45 million people. And then the Cultural Revolution after that, which is probably better known in the West, but was one of just really a string of disasters to accompany the first 30 years of CCP rule.
My guest is Ian Johnson. How has the approach to history changed under Xi? Because he seems to be harking back a lot to Mao.
Yeah, I think control of history has become one of his signature policies. He took power in 2012, and the next year he essentially outlawed criticism of the Mao era. In 2016, he closed a party-run, a party-approved journal. This is not an underground magazine, but an official magazine that ran articles that sort of exposed malfeasance or problems in the party's past. This was run by reformers in the party that thought they had to have an honest reckoning with their past. And indeed, one of its main supporters had been Xi's own father, Xi Zhongxun, who was a senior leader in the party in his own right, not as powerful as his son would become, but a very powerful figure. And he supported this magazine and thought it was necessary for the party to have an honest reckoning. This magazine got closed down, on and on. So throughout the 2010s and into the 2020s, this has become one of his key obsessions, really.
Well, you've describe it rather vividly as drawing a cartoonish version of history to justify the new leader's rule. Ian, let's dwell a bit on Xi's own personal history, because it's very much tied to the history of the party.
Yes, his father was one of the maybe top 20 or 30 officials in the CCP when the party took power in 49. He served under Mao, and he was purged in 1962 over, of all things, a historical novel which was written about the party's base camp where they had holed out during the Civil War and during the war against Japan. And this novel showed that there were other people other than Mao who were also quite capable leaders. Xi's father was identified as somebody who had supported this novelist and was purged. And this wasn't just a small thing. This was 20,000 people were purged in 1962 because of this novel. So Xi, I think early on in his life, at this point, he would have been just 10 years old. He realized the power of history in the party. And then, of course, when the Cultural Revolution took place 4 years later, his father was then further purged once again, sent to work in a factory. And Xi himself, as a teenager, was sent to live in an impoverished mountain area. So he could see firsthand the problem of history when he got on the wrong side of it, and that you had to maintain firm control over it.
And during the Cultural Revolution?
Yeah, in the Cultural Revolution, he lived in this cave area. He ran away from it. He couldn't stand it. Went back to his parents, and they essentially said, "You better put up with this." So he went back to this mountainous area where most of the people lived in caves. He stayed there for several years. He was one of the few literate people in the village, and so sort of rose up and then was able to forge a new career as a loyal party apparatchik, of course, with his powerful father behind him, and rise quickly through the ranks.
So Xi's father's reputation was rehabilitated in the late 70s, and remarkably, he was brought back into central government.
Yes, he was one of the chief architects of the early reform era. He was put in charge of Shenzhen. This is the special economic zone. It was just a fishing town across from Hong Kong. Of course, now it's this enormous megacity. And he helped launch that. And then, but he was a bit old at that point, and so sort of retired in the 1980s. But by then, he had launched his son into his own career.
Our guest is a veteran China journalist, Ian Johnson, and we're talking about his fascinating new book, Sparks, China's Underground Historians and Their Battle for the Future. Now let us meet some of the sparks. Tell us about Ai Xiaoming.
He is an interesting contrast to Xi Jinping. So Xi Jinping experienced the horrors of the early of the Mao era, the first 30 years of party rule, and decided, I have to fit into this party and make a career by not challenging anything, by supporting the party as closely as possible. Ai Xiaoming, about the same age as Xi Jinping, she drew a different conclusion. She also came from a fairly well-connected family. Her grandfather was a famous general in World War II who had led the ill-fated defense of Nanjing, which of course failed, and the Japanese then committed a terrible atrocities in that city. But he stayed on after the war. He didn't flee to Taiwan, and he was viewed as a patriotic general. She grew up in this household where the past was always very present and the party's influence was very, very strong. She was a small red guard in the Cultural Revolution. She was a bit too young to participate in the worst of the effects, but she even denounced her own parents and grandparents because she realized that they, she didn't, at the time as a teenager, she thought that they were not revolutionary enough. So she did everything the party really wanted, but with time, she began to realize, and especially into the 1980s, that the party's view of the past was warped and that it had to be challenged.
Now, the general was eventually arrested and in his 80s, for heaven's sake, and he dies in prison. And his mother went mad.
Yes, her grandfather was detained and then did die in custody. Imprisoned by Red Guards. Her mother, so in other words, the daughter of the general, she was forced to sweep out latrines and work in a park, sweeping the park for a long time, for years and years. And yes, she went mad and would walk around and talk to neighbors and say that he's going to be released soon, talking about her father, etc. She really realized the warped nature of the party's view of history, I think, and just decided that she would eventually, over time, she came to realize that she would challenge this.
Now, surprisingly, she spends a year in the U.S. in Tennessee, of all places, where she falls in love with movies, with the likes of French New Wave directors like Godard and Truffaut.
Yeah, she spent 1 year as a visiting scholar at the University of the South in Tennessee, and she spent most of her time checking films out of the library, bringing them home and watching them. This was the era of VCRs, and so she said she would be checking them out so often that she was maxing out her library card. The librarians thought it was very odd, but she had always been interested in film, but began to really put herself on a crash course of modern international film. So it included, as you say, new wave French directors, but also great documentary filmmakers of the Holocaust, people like Klaus Landsman, Marcel Ofuls, films like Hotel Terminus, Shoah. She watched all of these films and dissected them in a way that you do when you're studying it on your own, just trying to figure out why did the director put the camera in this direction and that direction, and why did they ask the question in this way or that way. And you can see she really picked up some of these techniques, especially I think of the Marcelo Fools. He has this way of asking a question and letting it hang there. And the person will sometimes say nothing or say a little bit, and she'll just let the silence grow and build and build. And eventually the person feels obliged to say more, and then they say more and more, and they essentially hang themselves by saying too much and admitting everything. And so she does this kind of, uses this technique in a lot of her films. So,
I think I'll try that technique in radio interviews and see if it works.
It's a bit art housey. I'm not sure how it'll go over, but yeah.
But she starts making her own films every 6 to 12 months, and they're considered quite radical.
Yes, she went back to China, and she brought back with her not only this new knowledge, but a manuscript for a play called The Vagina Monologues, which she has her students put on. And then she calls an old friend of hers, Hu Jie, who's probably the best-known independent film director in China, to come down and make a documentary of the students making this putting on this play. So he does that, and she begins to think, well, I could probably do this also. So he mentors her for several films where they begin to make some shorter films, say 30 minutes, 45 minutes, about events in the local area where she's living at this point in southern China in Guangzhou. And she gets more and more ambitious with time.
And she wants to make an epic documentary film about the labor camp. Could you share this with me?
This labor camp has subsequently, thanks to her efforts and the efforts of other people, become synonymous with, inside China at least, almost like a slang term for China's gulag. It's called jiabiango. It means essentially the ditch. And people will, even today, will sort of say to each other in a slangy way, watch out, or they're going to send you to jiabiango. This camp doesn't exist anymore. In fact, it was closed down in 1960. But for 3 years, it was essentially a death camp. It had thousands of inmates, most of whom perished of hunger. There was widespread cannibalism in the camp. And these were not just ordinary criminals. These were party officials who had been sent to the camp. And she made a film about this. That's a 4.5-hour film, very sophisticated. You can see it on YouTube. It's a really horrific film in many ways.
Now, introduce us to a citizen journalist, Zhang She. She too has a haunting family history.
Yeah, there are many people in China and probably around the world whose parents don't want to tell them about bad things that happened in their family history because they don't want to burden the kids with things that had happened in the past. But in Zhang She's family, her father insisted on telling the children every year the story of how his father, their grandfather, had sacrificed himself so that the family could survive. And this was during the Great Famine that killed up to 45 million people. He was given a ration. The whole family was given a ration of one big corn bun. It was about 6 inches in diameter. And he was a forced laborer at this time. There were six people in the family. It was him, his wife, and their four kids, and including Zhang Shui's father. And everybody in the family got the same amount, even the youngest child, as well as the father, who was forced to dig ditches outside. And so he died of starvation, but everyone else made it through. So on Chinese New Year's night, there's traditionally in Chinese culture a big feast, a big family reunion. But the father would insist, Zhang Shui's father would insist that they all go out to his father's grave in the back up the mountain and let him have the first plate of food, because without him, the family wouldn't be there. So she knew firsthand some of the traumas of the past. And I think this had a huge impact on her desire to tackle these sensitive issues.
Well, consequently, she becomes a journo in the early 2000s, which you remind us was that brief moment in time when journalism flourished in China.
It's remarkable in comparison today how journalism was so free. Media outlets had become partially marketized. They weren't privatized. They weren't sold off to private individuals, but they had to function on market concepts. So media companies were competing for readers and to come up with sometimes just salacious gossip, but sometimes also real scoops to lure readers to read the paper or watch the television, read the magazine, etc., just like in an open society. So she was at a media outlet at this heyday of journalism, this in China, this rare moment, which is probably the freest that it had been in China in 100 years, and was able to explore topics, investigate, and eventually write on corruption and other pertinent issues. That was really, for her, a moment of liberation and excitement in her life.
And this period of openness didn't last long, and the party starts to push back and crack down?
Yes, shortly after she takes power, the leading media outlet that represented this movement called Southern Weekend, they were gutted, essentially, and the liberal reform-oriented officials were replaced with party loyal people loyal to Xi Jinping. They were then, and she, at her media outlet called Huasheng Bao, she supported this media outlet, wrote editorials in favor of it, but was then forced to resign herself. So in about 2014, she quits the paper and becomes a freelancer and is now free to write about what she wants, but is also essentially free to be bankrupt because it doesn't pay very much money. But she did make money for a while on social media in China. There's a function at the bottom of some stories in China that would allow you to donate money to the writer, and she made a pretty good living for a few years doing that.
We'll come back to her a little later, but another character we meet in your marvelous book is Tan He Chung. Tell us about the massacre in Dao County.
In the Mao era, there was the caste society that had been created. There were five red elements, and these were the people who were glorious, at the glorious vanguard of the party, the soldiers, the workers, the party officials, etc. And then there were the five black elements, the people who were declared to be hopelessly, irredeemably against the state, even if they weren't necessarily against the state. And it wasn't just something that you did. You inherited this from your parents. So if your father had been a traffic policeman for the nationalist government, you were also a black element. So it could have been an innocuous job that your father had, but that was considered bad. And
utter madness, of course. Yeah.
It was absolute madness. And these people were then, in this one county, were massacred by the party, by party officials. It wasn't a spontaneous event. This was something that was orchestrated by the local party. In the 1980s, there was an effort to investigate this, and Mr. Tan went down with a delegation of 1,200 party officials to find out what the devil had gone on there, why 9,000 people had been murdered by the party. When the investigation team got back, the political climate had changed, and it was no longer possible to write about this. So the results of this investigation were never made public. But Mr. Tan, who had gone there as a state journalist, and he was basically just part of the team and had access to thousands and thousands of pages of documents and hundreds of oral history interviews, he thought, well, I'm going to write this because I promised the people I interviewed that we would make this public. So this kind of thing, this personality cult, this sort of thing wouldn't happen again. So he made it his life work. He went back to Dao County summer after summer on his own time to do more and more interviews, and published an epic book of hundreds of thousands of words, about 400,000 words, published in 2016.
Called Blood Myths.
Yes, called Blood Myths. There's an abridged version of it that's been published in the West called The Killing Wind. It's abridged, but it's still a pretty big book. It's about 450 pages.
Well, as you point out, it's an echo of Cambodia's killing fields.
Indeed, it was an echo of the killing fields and of other massacres. This was not a one-off, but there were an estimated 100 similar massacres that took place in the Cultural Revolution around this time.
The voice of Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ian Johnson, and we're talking about his book, Sparks, China's Underground Historians and Their Battle for the Future. Ian, I'd like for us to turn now to the journal, Spark. It's an important part of the story, and it's also, of course, the title of your book. What was Spark?
Spark was a student journal that was founded in 1960 by young people who had been studying at a university in Western China, at Lanzhou University in Gansu province, which is a quite a poor part of the country along the Silk Road in the northwestern part of the country. It has parts of the Gobi Desert in it and so on. They were caught up in a political campaign and exiled to an even poorer part of that particular province, where they saw firsthand the famine that was taking place, the great famine that killed up to 45 million people. They decided that they had to make people aware of what was going on. And in a maybe naive, quixotic fashion, they thought, yes, if we could just somehow publish something, get word out, the party would take action and stop the famine. So they got a hold of a mimeograph machine, which is an old piece of technology that many people may not be familiar with today, but it's a way of making copies, essentially. And they handwrote this journal. It was not sophisticated. There was no photos. It was handwritten on 8 pages of basically A4 paper. And they made about 100 copies of the magazine and sent it out. And then they made a second issue that was partly printed. But as you can imagine, this is the high point of Mao's totalitarian control. They are closed down very quickly. The party figures out almost immediately what's going on. The students are arrested. 3 of them are ultimately executed. Another 40 are sent to hard labor for up to 20 years. And that should have been the end of the magazine. The magazine, again, only maybe about 100 copies made. Most of them were confiscated. It didn't circulate widely. And it might have been just another one of these hopeless efforts that people made in the Mao period to fight back. Except in the 1980s, people were allowed to look into what's known as their personnel file, which is a file that's kept on everybody in China, including one of the women involved in the magazine. She saw in her personnel file the back copies of the magazine and 500 pages worth of police documents, all the confessions by the students, the police information, even the love letters that she'd written to her boyfriend, who was one of the 3 people executed. All of this was preserved in the file. She made photos of this and took it home to her apartment in Shanghai in the 1980s, where it sat around for a little while until the advent of the PDF in the 1990s, which allowed her to put this material together, essentially recreate the magazine and start emailing it out to people. So it's this simple digital technology that resurrected the magazine and allowed, I think, is one of the key reasons for the start of this independent history movement that's taken place over the past 25 years.
I have to ask you this, Ian. How much of an impact have underground historians actually made in China? You talk about, well, you ask, is their work pointless or trailblazing?
Yeah, I start the book out with a quote by Hannah Arendt, and she says that in dark times, when we see light, we don't know if it's just a flickering candle or if it's a blazing sun that's just far away. And I don't try to exactly answer that, but I do think that these people have been important For a couple of reasons. One is that there are independent history journals that are still published in China today that have been published for over 20 years. There are over 250 independent documentary films that have been made, many of them not well known in the West, but which represent, I think, a remarkable output. Obviously, the party is still in control. Xi Jinping is still in control. But word has spread. This is not just the work of a few dissidents in Beijing and Shanghai and a couple of other big cities. This is a much broader movement than that. And the fact that words like the name of that camp that I mentioned before, that it can be enter the slang on social media, that shows, I think, that these events have been resurrected. And while it's a small minority of people who know about it, I think change in any society always starts with small numbers of people. Whether this morphs into something bigger, I think we'll have to wait and see. But it really depends, I think, on China's trajectory. This is not the Soviet Union of the 1980s or just before the fall of the Iron Curtain. China is more like the Soviet Union in the 1960s, where the Soviet Union is still strong, but there are people like Solzhenitsyn beginning to set things down and to keep a record of it and so on.
Ian, what does all this mean for how we in the West should be, engaging with China?
What this means for our engagement with China is we should not assume that China has been completely erased by Xi Jinping, that we should just write it off, that there's nobody doing any independent work in China. When we wonder about how to engage with China, I think we should try to engage with these kinds of people. And that's why I set up a website called it's a charitable organization, it's called the China Unofficial Archives, which is a platform for these books and magazines and films that to give people in the West an idea of just the sheer scope and ambition of this work. So I think that when we look at China, we should maybe try to have a bit of the attitude that we had in the Cold War, when people like Solzhenitsyn and Kundera and Milos Forman, when they were household names for educated people in the West, so too should some of these Chinese people become better known for us. And we should have film festivals about them and invite them to our universities to be visiting scholars, et cetera, et cetera.
Ian, thank you for this. It's been an absolutely marvellous encounter. I've been talking to Ian Johnson, who is currently a Senior Fellow for China Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And Ian's book is Sparks, China's Underground Historians and Their Battle for the Future, published by Penguin. Thanks, Ian.
Thank you very much.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.